then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's April the 14th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
We begin, as always, with an Edgar Steele update. Now, the latest round of internet BS whirling like a dervish through cyberspace is that Mr. Steele is going to cop an insanity plea. In other words, he will allegedly admit that something happened, but he's going to say he was crazy at the time and so he's not responsible. This rumor is not true. Not only has Cindy Steele denied it in the media, for all the good it's done, but I've confirmed with the gentleman who's spearheading the more respectable wing of Mr. Steele's public defense effort that it's not true. Now, what started the rumor was that the judge ordered Edgar Steele to undergo examination by a government psychiatrist before his trial begins on April the 26th on the grounds that the defense is going to discuss Mr. Steele's mental and emotional state at the time the alleged conversations with Larry Fairfax took place. Now, there's no word as to whether Mr. Steele will be allowed to have his attorney present during the examination. Now, let me explain what this means. I need to remind everyone that in November of 2009, Edgar Steele suffered a massive heart attack, a ruptured aorta, and came about as close to dying as it's possible to come and still survive. He underwent several major surgeries, including at least one open-heart surgery, and in addition, he also apparently underwent a sinus surgery just a few days before the alleged hitman hiring conversation took place, and I didn't know this myself until recently. At the time of the conversations with Larry Fairfax, Steele was hopped up on every painkiller, surgical recovery drug, antibiotic, and blood thinner known to pharmaceutical science. And the defense intends to use this drugged state of his to explain to the jury how it is that the rodent Larry Fairfax was able to lead Mr. Steele into certain conversational pathways, and how Mr. Steele didn't pick up on where he was going with it because basically Steele was just too groggy to really know what was going on. By the by, the audio expert hired by the defense still claims that the truly crucial sections of the tapes, wherein Mr. Steele allegedly uses keywords like kill and money and pay or whatever, were in fact altered and fabricated by the government. Now, the prosecution claims that by bringing up Mr. Steele's highly medicated state at the time the alleged conversations took place, they themselves have raised an issue of mental competence. And it's the prosecution who have demanded that the psychiatric examination take place in order to throw mud in the eyes of the potential jury pool, and also, in my opinion, to confuse and demoralize Mr. Steele's supporters. Don't let him do it, folks. Okay, for the past few weeks, I've been playing audio recordings of various great racial nationalists from our past. Sir Oswald Mosley and the Kingfish Huey Long, and next week we'll introduce you to Father Coughlin. But this week we're going to go from the sublime to the ridiculous and play you another blast from the rather more recent racial past. Me, back in my Southern Nationalist days. I keep talking about how things were for me back in the day. Well, this is from back in the day. I pulled this off a YouTube video. A few words of explanation are necessary before I play it for you, though. Now, this speech was recorded in Pulaski, Tennessee on Martin Luther King Day, January 17, 1989. And I was addressing a hall of about 200 people, mostly Klansmen and skinheads, but including some dignitaries. In point of fact, this was where I first met Pastor Richard Butler. In addition to protesting the Martin Luther King holiday, we were also celebrating the formation of the Ku Klux Klan in Pulaski back in December of 1865. Now, bear in mind, this was my pre-Northwest migration days. At that time, I was a Southern nationalist working with a group called the Confederate National Congress. Now, some of the things I say in this speech may sound a bit out of kilter with my later Northwest advocacy, but bear in mind that this speech was recorded 22 years ago, and a lot has taken place in my personal and political development since then. However, you will note that I was already advocating a homeland for all white people even back then. I don't even remember this speech being recorded, but obviously it was. Later on, there was a street march, and I, as well as others, made a speech from the courthouse steps in Pulaski, with all kinds of screaming and hollering, niggers and other scum milling around and throwing things. There may be a tape of that floating around somewhere as well. Another word of caution here, the recording quality on this homemade video is not what it might be. Hopefully, we'll be able to clean it up for you with our magical editing skills here at Radio Free Northwest, so it'll sound a little bit more clear than maybe it does on the YouTube video. Anyway, here's my own much younger self, rousing the rabble down there in the land of cotton where old times be not forgotten, so forth and so on.
Congress is for Southern independence. We believe in the reestablishment of the legitimate authority of the Confederate States of America. Now, does this mean we're anti-Northern? No. And in order to illustrate this, I want to tell you a little story. I had the pleasure coming in today of meeting a fine comrade that I have not seen in, it would be going on 17 years now. This man is someone who's probably known to most of you. He has been with this movement since he joined the old American Nazi Party in the 1960s in California with Commander Rockwell. Late Commander George Lincoln Rockwell, I'm sure you all heard. Joined the movement, I was with the National Socialist White People's Party of Arlington, Virginia, and we were having on April the 20th a rally in Lafayette Park. This was in 1973, to celebrate the birthday of a certain gentleman I'm sure you're all familiar with. And eight of us went over to beforehand to set up the speaker's podium, the PA system, etc., etc. So we were sitting there in our allotted space in Lafayette Park, right across from the White House, setting up our speaker's podium, and all of a sudden looked around, and there were, I would say, at least 50 of the Bagel Boys of the Jewish Defense League surrounding us. Tire irons and the chains and the canes and so forth, and blah, 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 and they were going to do this, they were going to do that, rip the swastikas off our arms and so forth and so on. So we sort of formed a circle, and we awaited the onslaught, and I got a couple of good swats, but they sort of attacked behind me. And I heard this, the noise of the, first attack sort of behind me, and I glanced around, and I see this big, beefy New York Irishman. He's got Jews laid out in little rows. He's got three of them down. He's got a fourth one. He's got a grip one, and he's trying to fit his foot into his ear, which is a very poor fit. I think it is not an exaggeration to say that man probably saved the rest of us just by sheer physical prowess and sheer guts. He has stayed with the movement since then. He's among us today. He's right back there at the table. I'd like to introduce you, Sean McGuire.
Oh, yeah! Oh,
he's here. Oh,
yeah. I'm happy to say that Hal Covington here, a friend of mine of 17 years' time experience, has far surpassed my expectations, and he is known worldwide as an agitator for all white people's rights.
Let's not make it 17 years this time, okay? Alright, but the thing is that the word is said, I suppose it's a natural understanding. People think that Southern nationalists are anti-Northern, and after an experience like this, an experience with men like Ed Melkoni, whom I worked through in Chicago, and all the fine Northern and Western comrades, some of the skinheads here that I met just last night, the idea of Southern nationalists being anti-Northern in any way is just, it's ridiculous, it's ludicrous. We are not out to fight the Civil War over again. The white man in the North is not the enemy. He has never been the enemy. The enemy is, well, we all know who the enemy is. It's the government of Washington, and it is the Jews. Southerners have a very bad habit of cussing Yankees when they should be cussing Jews. And so I would like to take something to make it clear, first of all, that Southern nationalists are not anti-Northern in any way. We are doing what we are doing for the entire white race so that the white race can have a homeland, a piece of turf that we can call ours. somewhere on the face of this earth, there will be a piece of land, of territory, where we can raise our children in safety, and where we can prosper, where we can sell our labor and our skills for a decent, realistic price, where we can live without crime, without AIDS, without niggerism, without booga booga booga, without Martin Luther King holidays. But, well, we all know we're here to protest against that holiday, but there's another occasion that I think we also ought to bear in mind. I've heard it mentioned some, but I think it ought to be emphasized. In this little town of Pulaski, Tennessee, in the year 1866, a certain hooded order was founded by, I think, about six young ex-Confederate soldiers. It started out as a bit of a joke, just dress up in sheets and go around and scare the niggers, make them think we're ghosts. And it soon blossomed into something that the South had to have, something that was urgently required. It was the Ku Klux Klan. And at that point in our history, the Ku Klux Klan was a gift from God. And I will always thank God for the Ku Klux Klan. Many of you will have studied the history of the South. You will know the history of the war. If you read the accounts of what the South was like in 1865, 1866, no matter who was writing, who was commenting, be it a Northern abolitionist, a Democrat newspaper editor in the South, a Yankee schoolmarm come down here to uplift the noble African, whoever, they all remarked on the state of total destitution and desolation that existed in the South at the time. 300,000 of our men lay dead. Others were totally mangled for life. I can remember my grandparents in Greensville, North Carolina, talking of what they had seen in their youth, the old men sitting around the courthouse square with their arms and their legs blown off at Chickamauga or Gettysburg. Of course, in those days, if you were hit, that's all they could do. They just cut off whatever was hit, and hope to God that you didn't die. No one knows how many thousands of our people remained like this. Nobody knows how many homes were destroyed. Sherman, when he marched to the sea, cut a swath 60 miles wide, burning up everything. The railroad tracks were destroyed. All the rolling stock, the steamboats, everything was taken up north. The U.S. government, not having any IRS at the time, sent tax collectors down here to try and seize Southern property for payment for the Union war loans. They expected that the widows and the orphans of the South would pay money for the powder and the shot and the supplies that killed their husbands and their fathers. The South was destitute. It was desolate. The Freedmen's Bureau, this organized nigger thing that's sort of, I guess, the forerunner of the NAACP, lorded it over every county, every town in the South. Niggers, freed slaves, were given blue uniforms, guns, whiskey, and officered by sellout scallywag whites or northerners who were just down here to make a quick buck as carpetbaggers. They bullied, they shot, they raped, they burned. The South was prostrate. And then the Lord's hand moved, and the Ku Klux Klan arose, and it was just, it was miraculous. There is a myth that the liberal historians put forth that the South surrendered Appomattox. In April of 1865, when we surrendered, that was it. It was all over, and everybody just went home. That is not true. Our Southern ancestors fought a guerrilla war for 12 years, from 1865 until 1877, when the last federal troops were withdrawn from the South, to remove these occupying forces from the South and to get things back to some kind of sane Christian way of life. Many were killed. Many were interned. My own great-great-grandfather was a man named Hugh Glass. He was a slave owner. He was an officer in the Confederate Army. He joined the Ku Klux Klan after the war, and sometime along about 1870, I'm not sure which, he and his entire family had to flee from Virginia across the line into North Carolina and go into hiding because they were running from the federal troops. Our people suffered immensely, even more during the Reconstruction than they had during the war, and yet always, always there was resistance. The idea of Southern nationhood, Southern pride, and the white ideal of that pride never died, thanks largely to the Ku Klux Klan. There were times when the Confederate units reassembled, actually, to fight the Reconstruction government. You don't hear about this in your history books. The last land battle of the war was the Battle of Palmetto Hill on May the 12th in 1865 in Texas, the home state of Mr. Louis Beam. It was a smashing Confederate victory. They ran into an outfit called the Cavalry of the West, commanded by an ex-Texas Ranger named Colonel John Rip Ford. And they defeated three regiments of, quote, colored troops. They pushed those niggers into the sea. Union commander had to swim for his life to a Union gunboat off Galveston Island. This battle took place 6 weeks after Appomattox. Do we read about it in our history books? No, we don't. Because the South has been systematically stripped of her history, stripped of her pride. Now they want to take that flag down. Now they're trying to ban this last vestige of our national identity. They will not do it. We are determined in the Congress that the South shall rise again. We are doing what we are doing, not only for all Southerners, but for all white people the world over, as I've said, and we don't care about organizational designations. I don't care if a man calls himself a Klansman, an identity Christian, or being with the Congress, whatever, a skinhead. We must have three ideals, as far as I'm concerned. If you adhere to these ideals, you're one of us. First is that you must be sound on the racial question. Does anybody feel like niggers? Okay, well, now that's out of the way. Does anybody feel like Jews particularly? Okay, well, then we have the problem there. And the third is simply that you be unambiguous in your support for Southern independence. There are many of our Northern comrades here who feel like Bill. They're all for it, and we respect that. We accept the help gladly of our Northern comrades because, like I said, we are fighting for a peace of turf for all white people the world over. And when we win our independence, when that flag flies over our post offices and our government buildings again, all of you Northern comrades will be welcome to come down here, make your lives, bring your families, and we will build a white nation. The Rocky Mountain Republic has the same ideal, a white separatist nation in the five northwestern states. When they, too, triumph, we will have a peace of turf. And who knows, 2 generations from now, 100 years from now, who knows when it will happen. We will be strong enough to do what must be done, to take this country back from sea to shining sea, because all of this country is ours. This land does not belong to the niggers. Everyone says the niggers made a contribution. Well, that's true in a way. They contributed labor, but a nigger didn't do anything that a good draft horse couldn't have done twice as fast at half the expense. This country does not belong to the Chinese. This country does not belong to the Iranians who are flooding our everything, our streets, our grocery stores. You look at you, you're Spanish, you're Iranian, you're Chinese. This country does not belong to the Hispanics. This country does not belong to the Cuban criminals who were buffeted over here by Jimmy Carter by hundreds of thousands. The refugees, the scum of Castro's jails and mental institutions. This country isn't theirs. This country belongs to the white Christian people who made it. Our land. Our ancestors worked for it, toiled for it, bled for it. Their bones lie in the soil of the South. This is our land. We will not give up. The South will rise again.
A few weeks ago, I played the Welsh National Anthem, and I got some requests to the effect of, why don't I play all the national anthems of all the white nations around the world? Well, that would be a few too many national anthems, and we'd be playing them until August, and people would get real bored with it. But I figure I can pick out at least three. The first thing I'll do is to play for you the National Anthem of Russia. Now, I've played some Russian music on here before, some Ivan Rebrov, the Soldier's Chorus from the Dmitry Shapurin opera, The Decembrists, and a few more pieces. But I've never really talked about Russia that much on here because in many respects it's not a very pleasant story. The history of Russia for the past century is one of almost unmitigated horror. World War I, and then the 1917 Bolshevik takeover, the Civil War, the first famines, and then the ultimate horror of Stalin, followed by the Second World War, more Stalin, then a slow decline for 2 generations into total corruption. Then came Glasnost and the breakup of the Soviet Union, with all kinds of mess in Chechnya and all over. And then there were 10 years of rule by the Mafia, and about 6 Jewish supercapitalists called oligarchs, so forth and so on. Vladimir Putin seems to be finally pulling the country out of the mess, but by now, let's face it, mentally and emotionally and morally and economically, the Ruskies are in bad shape. They're abused and scarred people. They don't seem ever to be able to do anything in their country without killing a few million of their own people. And yet from everything I've read about them, and from the ones that I've met personally, they're an amazingly tough and resilient people. They're the worst drunks in the world, but my God, they have reason to be. Their winners alone are enough to drive anybody to drink. And I have to say that right now, they're in a lot better racial and moral shape than we are. I never thought I'd see the day when Russia might be the only country in the world to offer genuine old-fashioned Americans any kind of refuge. But that's the way it's worked out for David Duke and some others I could name. Anyway, any nation of really tough bastards who survived Stalin has earned our respect and admiration, and so this is their anthem. Before we move on here, a quick social note. This weekend, I'm going to be doing something that I haven't done in quite a while. I've been invited to a wedding. Two of our younger people here in the Northwest are getting married. I hope this is a kind of invitation I'll be getting more and more of. It just goes to show you guys, it's happening. Way too slowly, but it's happening. I have an email here from Frank in Ohio, and he asks a question that I know a lot of you must have thought about down through the years. And he puts it pretty bluntly. Dear HAC, I would like to hear your unvarnished take on exactly why the movement has failed for the past 50 years and how we have reached the point where we are now left with the sole alternative of trying to grab back a small portion of what was once ours. I'm a former National Alliance member, and I've already shared with you some of my ideas as to why the NA itself went down, but I'm speaking in a broader sense here. Why the hell has the white man never been able to get it together in this country? Hoo boy, Frank, you're asking for it now, my man. Now, you listeners who followed me down through the years will recall that I have in the past addressed a few words to this topic. A few. For those of you who came in late, I will refer you to my 1998 and still relevant article, The Song, Not the Singer, which I'll be glad to send you a copy of by email if you request it. I've been informed by a number of readers down through the years that it's considered to be the definitive word on the subject. I'll give you a brief recap. I should also state that by the term movement, I mean all of us. Klan, National Socialist Militia, National Alliance, Christian Identity, Duck Book, Cardo People, Populist Party, everybody, including myself. I was part of this mess too, and I made my share of mistakes, just not the ones the goat dancers accuse me of. Despite a few bright spots, the movement of the past 50 years was frankly a damn near total failure. By that I mean it has failed to do what it was supposed to do, which is to secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. In the light of this failure, pretty much everything else is really irrelevant. All the quote-unquote education in the world is as useless as tits on a bull unless there is actual physical political change on the ground, and there has been none. Yes, there were a few bright spots, such as the life and work of George Lincoln Rockwell, and I can't deny that a lot of the stuff we did back in the day was more fun than a barrel of monkeys, but we weren't there to have fun. Okay, why did we fail? About 100 reasons, but just off the top of my head, I'd say 3 fundamental ones. There were many secondary contributing factors, but these are the primary reasons why we have accomplished zip in the past 50 years. Number 1. A preoccupation with an idealized past. This is the most humanly understandable and forgivable reason. Instead of looking forward, we keep trying to turn back the clock. Entirely too many of us have never been true revolutionaries. We've been conservatives who hate niggers. We keep trying to recreate our favorite historical epochs. The Third Reich, the Confederacy, Puritan New England, the world of Ozzie and Harriet, the world of the Brady Bunch, the world of George Lincoln Rockwell on Hatemonger Hill. Hell, we've even got a form of 80s nostalgia going on now. I speak now as someone who's been guilty of this very thing in the past, and I don't deny that. I had my Third Reich phase, although I did grow out of it fairly young. Guys, I'm sorry. The clock moves forward. Not backward. I wish it were otherwise. It took me a long time to learn this, guys. Don't you be as slow a learner as I was. You mustn't be, because we are now out of time. The demographic clock is ticking. Number 2. Our consistent failure to deal with the issue of our own character. Got a hot flash for you guys. Character counts. Don't believe that? Then look at where we are today. We've more or less ignored the issue of character in our leadership and in our membership for 50 years, and you see what the result has been. Speaks for itself, guys. We have allowed ourselves to be represented in public by people that the original Ku Klux Klan would have lynched and whom Adolf Hitler would have sent to a concentration camp. And now we're paying the price. I say again, the demographic clock is ticking, and our remaining time is running very short indeed. Now, reason number 3 why the movement has been such a complete failure, and that is the total lack of anything remotely resembling a plan. Our complete lack of progress was part and parcel of our complete lack of program. There was always an overall pervasive atmosphere of cluelessness, a sense of drift in the movement. Now, I was always aware of this, but over the past few years it's become glaringly obvious that this is what always caused us to just sort of disperse like the morning mist, even after we were riding high with some publicity on things like Operation Skokie or Greensboro. Down through the years, our numbers have grown fewer and fewer. In the 1950s, it was by no means unknown to have 25,000 people at a Klan march or a rally. Now today, a so-called rally is considered a success if it has more than a dozen participants wearing weird costumes. Now, after Dr. Pierce's death, Billy Roper pulled out all the stops, and he managed to get almost 500 people to Washington, D.C. Okay, we'll accept the media's estimate out of courtesy. Now, these were mostly skinheads and other people who had no connection at all to the National Alliance, but it is a performance for which Billy Roper deserves major kudos. That's about the best we've ever done. For an American activity, that's top-notch. In Europe, even today, it wouldn't have raised an eyebrow. But that is going to be our high watermark for a long time. No way we're ever going to get that many again, barring some kind of major national situational change. And everybody listening to these words knows that, including Mr. Roper himself, I suspect. I'm not saying it's all over, guys. I'm saying it never really began. Since 1945, there has never been any real plan until now. There has never been any kind of political horizon. The closest we ever came was with groups like the John Birch Society and the UKA, the United Clans of America, and the goals of those groups are similar to that of a right-wing or racist Rotary Club or JCs. More and bigger rallies, more publicity, more trinkets and books and videos sold, so forth and so on. Now we are out of time. 50 years pissed up against the wall. The old movement has failed. All intelligent white nationalists know that it has failed. We simply can't spend another 50 years doing exactly what we've done for the past 50 with no significant changes of any kind. Self-appointment, costumes, silly public activities that make us look weak and ridiculous, no political plan or horizon at all, no attempt to set standards or address the issue of character at all. Now we either unite behind the Northwest Imperative and actually start doing things instead of tapping on computers, or we're done and the white race is done with us. Okay, I'm going to cut that one short because it's a subject that I have spent years ranting and raving about, and if I don't cut myself off, I'm going to spend the rest of this podcast just rehashing things I've been saying for the past 20 years. Now, I'm going to talk about employment here in the Northwest. Right, lads and lassies, time for some home truths about gainful employment here in the homeland. First off, despite the Democrats' best efforts, this is still a capitalist society. That is not a political statement, it's a simple statement of the reality with which we all have to live. This means that no one cares. No one cares about you unless you can do something for them. Employers do not care about you unless you can convince them that you can give them labor greater than the value of whatever pittance they pay you. When you apply for a job, don't bother them with sob stories, even if you are likely to go home and find your landlord just shoved all your stuff out on the curb and lock you out of your crib. Remember, employers already have jobs, so they don't care. They don't care about your problems, and they do not wish to hear them. They don't care about your bills. Your family is a matter of complete indifference to an employer. You must approach them with, quote-unquote, I can put money and value in your pocket in this and that way. And that is all they care about. Every society has certain jobs that are so dirty, so crappy, so boring and pointless, with working conditions so medievally brutal and so inconvenient of time and access that even in the worst economic times, the capitalist economy can't get anybody to fill them for long. Now, if you're serious about coming here and you're short on formal qualifications and experience like a lot of young white people are, you need to identify these jobs and be willing to do them. First off, there's your basic Pacific Northwest job where you drive 80 miles round trip each day to do back-breaking manual labor for minimum wage and no benefits. Temp agencies here always have a couple of those on file. This is called the keep your ass out of the homeless shelter job. They are always around. I'll give you an example. Right now, there's a temp agency in Chehalis, Washington that has been advertising almost every week for dozens of people to sort and box and later go out into the hills and plant seedlings for a paper company nursery. They can't seem to keep anybody, possibly because the ICE keeps raiding them and carting away all their Mexicans. Now, I looked into this job. It is so far out in the boondocks that you have to worry about Sasquatch attacks. An over 100-mile commute from Chehalis, where you'd have to go down winding forest roads in the winter and in the dark. These jobs are available right now at $10.50 per hour. They're so desperate for people on this one, you don't even have to speak Spanish. There is always a warehouse somewhere up here that needs mules with strong backs to hump incredibly heavy metal things. Now you can find them if you look. Let me give you guys a hint, by the way. Learn to operate a forklift at an early age. Beyond that, there is one absolutely guaranteed growth industry in this country, geriatric care as the baby boomers age. As a general rule, when you're thinking of retraining, try to get into something medical that involves taking care of old people. If you have the money to go through nursing school, do it by all means. Right now, if you look at the papers, you'll see that every place in the Northwest, from Seattle to Ponderay, is screaming like banshees for nurses of any kind, any description, any qualification. On a lower level, you can get a 4-week CNA or NAC nurse's aide course that will hire you on afterwards if you're willing to change old people's diapers and wipe their bottoms. Now, if you can show 1 year's experience as a CNA, you can walk into any old folks' home in Washington and you can start at about $17 an hour. The top flight for jobs like this is working in long-term institutions. You've heard of the men in the white coats, the orderlies and the mental institutions, that sort of stuff. Those guys are CNAs. They're so desperate for anyone who will change those diapers and wipe those bottoms and mop up those messes that they probably won't be too fussy about past mistakes along racial and political lines. This might be a good gig for some of you with those annoying felony bounces on your record. If you're one of the lucky ones who has the time and 2 years minimum and above all the money to retrain properly and some way to pay rent and stay out of the homeless shelter while you go to school, try to get into something medical, lab-related, or better yet, medical record transcription. It's cleaner, you make more money, and you don't have to wipe 80-year-olds' bottoms. There are a few places that you can get a medical transcriptionist certificate in a year, but I understand that a lot of people who enter the medical field but who have no technical skills have already spotted this one, so there may be a coming glut of newly qualified transcriptionists. I'm not being cynical or funny here. It's a simple fact. If you're willing to deal on a daily basis with elderly people and keep them clean, you will always work. Don't believe me? Check out the want ads in your next Sunday paper. Now, if all this sounds a little bit cynical and icky for you, once again, I will tell you how to make sure that you always work in the Northwest or, frankly, anywhere else. Learn to do something with your hands that involves fixing the rich man's toys when they break. Learn to fix his luxury car. Learn to fix his boat. Learn to fix his computer-related toys. Learn to dry clean his clothes so he doesn't have to deal with Chinese and Middle Easterners who don't speak English. Learn to be a cordon bleu chef so you can cook rich people's food in expensive restaurants, or better yet, learn to be a waiter in those restaurants and kiss his butt so he leaves you $100 tips. The possibilities are endless. It's a simple fact of life. If you want money in a capitalist society, you have to go to those who have it. And in this specific capitalist society, those who have it are some more than usually unpleasant people. You have to get some of what they have so that you can continue to function. You can't create a new country and a new world while you're living under a bridge with all your possessions in a shopping cart. Okay, on to our second national anthem. In recent years, the French have gotten a very bad rap, and that kind of surprises me. You see, this first started back in 2003 when the French refused to go along with the Son of Big Iraq attack, and all Jogier's little Jewish friends and their Yehu John Wayne wannabe chorus started calling the French surrender monkeys, whatever the hell that means. But when you think about it, why exactly should the French or anybody else jump when we whistle and attack and invade a foreign country that never did anything to them just because some turkey like George W. Bush, with nothing but pork fat between his ears, tells them to? The French didn't have any beef with Saddam Hussein. Of course, neither did America, and that didn't stop us. And yes, I know Sarkozy is a Hungarian Jew, and he's married to a former stripper and a hooker. I never said French politics wasn't sleazy. Actually, it's always been sleazy. One French president died of a heart attack while he was in bed with a woman, not his wife, and their financial scandals are as juicy as any in Washington or London. On the other hand, France historically has a very strong anti-Jewish tradition. They are very famous for the anti-Jewish Dreyfus affair. And when the French army overran the Paris Commune in 1871, which was one of the first actual Marxist communist revolts, they flat out gunned down about half of the Reds, and they shipped the rest off to Devil's Island. The French reputation for being pansies militarily isn't deserved either. Now, you remember the OAS back in the 60s? No, I know you don't. I don't have time to get into it, but Jean-Marie Le Pen from the National Front was in the OAS, put it that way. Actually, since World War II, the French have probably intervened militarily in the Third World far more than anybody else, but only when their own interests are threatened. And even when they do, they don't make a big deal of it. They go in, they get what they got to do done, and then they leave. Remember, it wasn't the Americans who first bombed Libya a few weeks ago. It was the French, when Gaddafi got all pissed off and he said he was going to cut off their oil supply. France has kept a tight economic grip on her former colonies in Africa and Asia, and they'll put up with a lot from their puppets like the Emperor Bokassa in Central Africa so long as they keep the raw materials coming and behave themselves more or less. But when they screw up too bad, and they don't keep the flow of raw materials and goodies coming to French companies, France will send in the Foreign Legion and the paratroopers and boot those Kaffirs out, just like they did with Bokassa, and like they did just a few days ago in the Ivory Coast, when they sent the tanks in to that jive-ass nigger Laurent Gbagbo's hole in Abidjan, and they dragged his black ass right out of there wearing a t-shirt and handcuffs. The French national anthem is called La Marseillaise, and it was first written in 1789 after the fall of the Bastille, when the French National Assembly refused an order from King Louis XVI, and they gathered in a tennis court and they swore an oath that they would not disperse until they'd created a constitution and limited the monarchy, which they eventually limited 4 years later by cutting off the king and queen's heads. But in that first year of the revolution, support was pretty shaky, and the convention had to call on local militias to come to Paris and enforce their authority. A one column of militiamen from Marseille marched into Paris one summer day with muskets and pikes and pitchforks, and a man named Claude Joseph Delisle was so inspired by the sight of these reinforcements marching down the street as they entered the city that he wrote this song, which is kind of like Francis Scott Key wrote the Star Spangled Banner at the bombardment of Fort McHenry. Only the French did it a couple of decades before us. Anyway, this is La Marseillaise.
Oh,
After we arrive in the Northwest homeland, our first order of business is to make sure that we stay there. If you find yourself in a situation where 6 months after you arrive, you've lost your job at the Burger King because you showed your butt and your face appeared on local TV as a racist, and your rent is due and you've got no money and a little woman's crying to go back to mama in the mall in Milwaukee, then the chances are you wasted your scouting trip, or what's worse, you didn't make one. No one is telling you to throw all your goods in the U-Haul and head out to Idaho without a place to live, a job, or a plan, least of all me. Now, some guys do just that, and they make it fine. I did. But if you do, you need to understand that there's a chance that in 6 months' time, you're going to be hurting. Now, if that happens, no, you weren't conned by wicked evil Harold. You tripped over your own shoelaces because you wasted your scouting trip or you were damn fool enough not to make one. Right now, today, there is no mystical Aryan paradise in the Northwest, whatever efforts we may exert in the future to create one. Are we clear on that? Yes, there are blacks and Mexicans here. Yes, there is unemployment here. No one is denying that, least of all me. You're coming to make a home here and build a future, and that entails all the same things that a home elsewhere does. Bills and responsibilities and problems. This is the biggest step we'll ever take in our lives, the strongest and most important personal commitment we'll ever make, second only to marriage. We need to make sure we know what we're doing, where in the homeland we're going, and how we'll proceed when we get there. There is an old saying, no matter where you go, there you are. Mere residence in the Northwest is not going to be a magical solution to all your problems in life, and if that's what you come expecting to find, then you're going to be in trouble. The first colonists on the eastern seaboard of this country did not land at Jamestown and Plymouth Rock and then immediately begin plotting to win independence from King George. They had all they could do just to survive during that first 100 years or so. A few people actually know much of the real history of our country, and so few realize that up until about 1700 or so, English colonization in America was by no means an assured thing. As late as that year, the men who had been struggling to build Charleston, South Carolina for 30 years were seriously considering upping stakes and returning to Barbados, where most of them came from. You have to understand that before we can consider rebelling against the king in Washington, D.C., we have to get our cabins built and get our crops planted and harvested and sink our roots deep into the soil of the land we'll be defending. Now, the first step is to assess yourself and your resources accurately. Much of your future success, or lack thereof, in the Northwest homeland is going to depend on your marketable skills, or lack of them. At the risk of repeating what I just said a few minutes ago, if I had to give one single piece of advice to the exclusion of all others to young white people today, it would be this. Learn a trade. Carpentry or electrician skills or plumbing or bricklaying if you're good with your hands. Something like computers or lab technician or dentistry or something like that if you're scientifically inclined. Drafting or anything that will keep you economically viable and make you pretty much invulnerable to the economic pressure that the Jews use to keep us in line. Because if you can do something and do it well, you will eventually find someone who wants your skills badly enough to pay for them, despite whatever Jewish blacklist you may be on. Now, if you don't have skills, and you're young, and you can go to school to learn them, I urge you to enter technical college or whatever you have to do to get the necessary training. And if possible, do it here in the Northwest. One of the things Northwest Front will soon begin providing through our website and other resources is lists of colleges and technical schools in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. In fact, we've already produced such lists. Lists of colleges and employment sources and contact emails. I sent them out and they just seemed to fall into disuse after a while for lack of interest. And then 6 months later, somebody complains, "Oh, Harold, you don't have a list of Northwest colleges on your website. What are you doing up there?" And so I have to go and dig up the list again, check all the links, and do the kind of things that a general headquarters staff should be doing, but we won't get into that. If you're still a young enough dog to teach new tricks, I urge you to enroll in courses at your local institutions of learning once you arrive in the homeland. It will not only increase your economic viability, but it will get you into interaction with local people. I'm always amazed to learn from prospective migrants that we apparently have no technical colleges or institutions of learning at all here in the Northwest, and they must, absolutely must, sit on their can in Florida or California or Wisconsin or New York and complete some degree because they just can't possibly come here to the Northwest and find an equivalent school. Oh, no, they just can't possibly come now. Gotta stay there where they are to get educated. I guess we all just live in log cabins up here. Now, what you do not want to do, if it can be at all avoided, is to rock up in some area of the Northwest with high unemployment and go looking for some $6 or $7 an hour unskilled labor or service job. The competition for these jobs in areas outside the metropoli is fierce, and local people understandably resent outsiders coming in and taking them. We want those jobs taken away from the locals by Mexicans and Asians, not by evil white racist interlopers who can be blamed with social approval in a way that the Hispanics and the Asians can't be blamed under political correctness. Clear your decks as best you can before you leave for the homeland. Your debts and legal issues are not going to just go away as if you were fleeing the country. The Northwest is, after all, not a true frontier yet, and it's still part of the evil empire. The bill collectors and the police and your ex-wife's attorney can find you here and get at you here. If you try to resettle in the Northwest with a lot of excess baggage left over from the old country, it will follow you here and cloud your first years in the homeland. I want this to be as much of a new start for all of us as is possible to obtain in today's world. Now, on to the scouting trip. Before you set foot in the Northwest for the first time, make every effort you can to study everything about our new homeland, from the economic demographics to the weather to real estate prices. Now, if, like most people, you have to work a 9-to-5 rat racer, then your time for your scouting trip will be limited, as will your budget. You'll need to have a good idea before you arrive for your first visit of what you're looking for, what the needs of you and your family will be, and what you'll be able to afford. A most important question, are you skilled? Do you have a marketable manual trade like plumbing or auto mechanics or computer hardware assembly and repair that is of use in a rural or small town environment? Now, this will determine what range of options you have. Okay, I'm well aware that many of you will in fact be coming to the homeland looking for just those $6 and $7 an hour jobs because you can't do anything else yet. If that's the case, then to be frank, you need to forget about the little cabin in the woods in northern Idaho and concentrate on the metropolitan areas in Oregon and Washington, where simple labor and service jobs are still, there, if not reasonably plentiful. At least they're here. As an aside, without naming any names or getting into details, I want to mention something to you guys, and that is that a newly arrived migrant here in Seattle, whom I spoke with this morning, reports for his first full day of work on his new job today, Wednesday the 13th of April. This is the day I'm actually making this recording. Okay, this guy doesn't really count as a migrant since he actually came here from another part of the Northwest. I don't like cannibalizing the homeland itself. We need to start seeing out-of-state license plates here. But I mention this to confirm that there are jobs here, and you can get them. This guy got one in about 3 weeks, and he had to come to Seattle for one prior interview. It can be done, people. Everything I have been talking to you about, from getting a job to the NVA, can be done. A look at a map indicates that we really have about 15 settlement areas in the Northwest which are economically viable for those of us who are dependent on actual employment for income as opposed to self-employment, starting your own business, whatever. These basically fall into two overall geographical areas. There's the I-5 corridor running along the Pacific coast from the Oregon state line up to Canada. and the Spokane Coeur d'Alene area in eastern Washington and northern Idaho. Plus, there's a few odd dots off to one side, like Bend, Oregon, and Boise, Idaho, that fall somewhat out of these areas but into the areas of economic viability. Quick note on this objection that, oh, the Northwest is full of liberals. No, Portland and Seattle and Eugene are full of liberals, and to a much lesser extent, so are Spokane and Boise. You get out in the countryside here, and it's just as much redneck rifle rack in the pickup truck territory as the South. I think some of the mountain men out here even chew beech nut. Seattle and Portland and a couple of other metropolitan areas skew the area blue, so to speak. Now, if you look at a color electoral map of the 3.5 homeland states, you will see one mass of red with about 5 or 6 large blue splotches where, unfortunately, most of the money and the population are concentrated. Now, we need to get out of the habit of avoiding difficult situations and taking the line of least resistance. If the I-5 corridor and the Puget Sound and Portland areas really are these great bastions of liberalism, then that's where we need to start getting to work and bringing people in and making it a bit less liberal. We're not running away from obstacles by coming to the homeland. We're simply opting to fight our battle here with comrades around us. Okay, I'm just kind of rambling here trying to answer general questions that come up. One reason I like living in Washington is simply because I really enjoy having no state income tax. I got used to that little convenience down in Texas. That's less money out of my pocket every paycheck and less bureaucracy to deal with come April 15th. Washington State also has good handgun, concealed carry, and open carry laws for those of you who are into the Second Amendment. All right, rather than go on rambling, let's go for our third national anthem. This one is really heartbreaking. It's called Die Stimme von Südafrika, The Call of South Africa. And it's the national anthem of South Africa before they voted their country out of existence on March the 17th, 1992. I will never, as long as I live, understand why they did that. There was no need for it. South Africa manufactured or otherwise produced everything they needed to survive. Now, you know, there are still almost 5 million white people in the country, and if they decided to act, they could still bring it back. Anyway, this is sung first in Afrikaans and then in English.
Thank you.
Now I want to say a few things, just FYI for all of you. As I mentioned earlier, I'm making this recording on Wednesday, April the 13th. Yesterday, something came up. One of our web guys reported to me that some rather unpleasant people whose identities are known to us have been poking around our website, and there may be some kind of attempt made in the near future to use the abuse of civil litigation to try and shut us down and confiscate the NorthwestFront.org domain name. David Duke was recently subjected to a lawsuit of this kind from some media chain that runs the Las Vegas newspaper in an attempt to seize any bank accounts he may still have in this country and also to seize the domain name for whitecivilrights.com and shut down the site. The reason we know that this happened is because the newspaper chain recently announced that it had reached an out-of-court settlement with Duke on the lawsuit. I know details are available, but I guess Duke must have paid him off at least some token amount because whitecivilrights.com is still up. In addition to which, it looks like there has been some messing around at our Seattle post office box. Mysterious men in suits showing up and trying to get information, filing complaints, trying to persuade the post office to close the box, which they refuse to do. In fact, I just yesterday renewed the box for another year, so these people have failed completely to cut us off postal-wise. Now, I won't name names, but I will say one thing. This interference and surveillance we detected on our website is the enemy themselves, thank God, and it's not just one of our own sillies for a change. God, it's such a refreshing change to have actual racial enemies coming after me again. Jews and cops and federal agents and NGO ops and not marginal loons who claim to be white nationalists. Now, it's possible that this outfit who are sniffing around NorthwestFront.org are planning something like this. They're going to try and sue us and take the domain name, whatever. We don't know for sure. Nothing's happened yet. They're just sniffing around and showing up on our stat counter and track back and page load tracker, so forth and so on. Along with Army Intelligence and the Spokane Police and Naval Intelligence and about 6 different FBI offices and dozens of anonymous proxy servers every day who could be anybody. According to what we find on the internet, this particular group of individuals has been involved in this type of activity before, and they've been accused of having contacts with DHS and the CIA and acting as a legal front for these government agencies in order to mess with dissident websites. Now, we do know that the secret police do make use of subcontracting NGOs like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League in order to do the things that they can't do, such as gather information about people in ways that secret police organs either can't do legally or they don't want to waste time and effort doing, so forth and so on. I'm just letting everybody know about this now, in the unlikely event that we suddenly disappear off the web one day. Now, the Northwest Front already has one alternate backup site in place with a full archive of Radio Free Northwests, and we're working on a backup or mirror for the present main party website just in case. However, you guys may want to download or copy anything you want off NorthwestFront.org site just in case it goes poof. I also want to say that this kind of thing comes with a territory. When you spend your life poking at a dangerous animal with a stick like we do, the beast is going to snap back at you. Of course it will. I have known so-called white nationalists who talked and wrote a good game for years sometimes, and then the first time a couple of droids actually physically showed up on their doorsteps and flashed their badges, these people crumpled and fled into the night. Or else they got all hysterical, like the roof was caving in, and they're getting visited by our friends in the silk suits was the most horrible and terrible act of tyranny in the world. Real drama queens. Now, I've never been like that. I've always understood that, as Nietzsche said, when you stare into the abyss, sometimes the abyss will stare into you. Every week, I write things and I say things on this program that some very powerful people dislike intensely. And judging by recent signs, we're finally attracting their notice. I fully expect that at some point in the future, some attempt will be made to silence me, either through a malicious and abusive lawsuit, or through some kind of fabricated legal case, as happened with Edgar Steele. Maybe the FBI will send a wired handyman to me and try and get me to hire him as a hitman, for all I know. Or, more likely, one day I'll make a slip with something I say on here, and I'll say something that some U.S. attorney can, through some really bizarre stretch of the law, claim constitutes threatening or inciting violence against somebody. Now, we tend to forget that right now there are white men in prison for doing nothing at all besides saying or publishing things on the internet. This is America. We have a constitution. That's not supposed to happen in this country, but it does to people with white skins who say things and publish things on the internet that the government does not like. You remember Bill White? He's doing 3 to 5 years right now for publishing a piece of information on his old website at overthrow.com, which was, in fact, a matter of public record, and which can still be found in 3 minutes by anyone who knows how to use Google. I remember Johnny Logan Spencer, 5 years in the federal pen for publishing a poem criticizing Obama on NewSaxon.org, and he was charged 2 years after the poem was posted. You remember Matt Hale, 40 years in prison for typing a single sentence into an AOL Instant Messenger chat room, that sentence being, quote, "I cannot be involved in this." 40 years for typing a single sentence into a chat room, and I kid you not, I'm not making that up. That is the essence of the case against Matt Hale. Now, will I slip up eventually? Maybe. I remember what Agent Richard Goldberg of the FBI told me many years ago. He said, "Harold, if we want you out of circulation bad enough, we can get you anytime we want to." Yes, they can. I've always known that. But until they do get me, we keep on trucking. When our website goes down to a malicious and abusive lawsuit, we go to a backup site. When the backup site is pulled offline, we go to a second backup site, so forth and so on. They try this crap on YouTube all the time with Colonel House, and he just keeps opening up new accounts and uploading his videos. He's got about 6 or 8 YouTube sites now, as well as all the other people who've uploaded his videos to their own YouTubes. Those videos will never be offline again from now on. That's how it's done. It's impossible to force anybody off the internet who really wants to be there. The system has all kinds of ways to try and do an end run around the First Amendment. Now, they haven't tried arresting me on some fabricated charge yet, but they have tried baseless and malicious lawsuits and court injunctions and contempt orders when I still won't shut up. Now, that crap has been going on for almost 15 years now, and they haven't succeeded in silencing me yet. This kind of thing is part and parcel of the life we choose. Dr. Goebbels once said that if he awoke in the morning and he did not find himself slandered and attacked in the enemy media, and policemen and Jew lawyers banging on his door trying to make him shut up, then it meant that he had wasted the previous day. Judging from the number of vicious and slanderous attacks against me on certain blogs and internet sites, I don't waste too many of my days. So I'll sign off with a few quick words to all you assholes in the expensive suits who have been sleazing around our website and our post office box and trying to find some way to do what the Constitution says you can't do, i.e. silence somebody you don't like and whose message you don't want heard. You can sue me, but you can't silence me. If necessary, I will simply ignore any judge or court order or lawsuit that violates my rights and orders me into silence. I have done so before, and I will continue to do so. Whatever happens in such a case, the one thing that will not happen under any circumstances is that I will fall silent, so you might as well not bother. You can arrest me and charge me with fabricated crimes, which you know full well I did not commit. And you may succeed in silencing me simply by burying me alive in a cell and cutting me off from the outside world, as you have buried alive the women of Coffee Creek. But my novels and my voice are already out there in sufficient quantities so that you will never be able to track down and destroy every single copy of my books or my podcasts. For better or worse, my words will live on beyond what any lawyer or judge or secret policeman or prison warden can ever do to me. You can destroy me, but you will never defeat me, and I think we both know it. Well, my voice is about shot now, so our time is up, and that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sarsha Andaban. Freedom. Freedom.